Good afternoon. I'll call to order the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water. It's Tuesday, May 31st. We have a couple of items on the agenda today. We're going to hold off on the work session on Senate Bill 518, still dealing with possible amendments and want to hear from the director. So we'll do that towards the end of this session, which is unlikely to go all the way until 5 o'clock. But the bulk of our agenda is an informational meeting, which I'll open, and we're hearing from the Port of Portland on their Sustainable Aviation Fuels Project. My co-chair, who will be holding the gavel for most of this meeting, has to testify, I think, in another committee. He helped put this agenda together, but I'm very glad to be hearing it. And we have a panel of four. We've added a chair. So we'll bring all four of you up for this, and in whatever order you have prepared.
We have a last-minute cancellation amendment. This is not accurate. It's Megan Lawrence is the...
Okay, so five. You know who you are. Five. There are five of you. Yeah. Someone in the on-deck search.
Yeah.
So take it away, whatever order. And great. Please begin by introducing yourself for the record.
Will do. My name is Phil Ralston. I'm General Manager for Aviation, Environmental, and Safety at Portland International Airport with the Port of Portland. And I'll be sort of the MC of the group here, kind of herding the cats. I do want to thank you all for making the time to be informed on this topic. It's really critical. There's an imperative from an environmental, economic, and national security point of view that we build up an aviation biofuels industry. And we'll get into more details later. But first, I wanted to thank you all for your time. And I think we decided to self-introduce ourselves, so I did that, and we'll move to my left.
Thank you for having us today. My name is Darren Morgan. I'm Director of Sustainable Aviation Fuel Strategy at the Boeing Company. And I think, are we just going through the presentation, or are we just introducing?
Just introducing right
now. Great.
And I'm Megan Lawrence, Managing Director of Government Affairs for Alaska Airlines.
And I'm Bill Bogus. I'm the Executive Associate Dean of the College of Agricultural Sciences at Oregon State University and also the Director of the Western Regional Center of the Sun Grant, and I'm here representing that Sun Grant Association and OSU via in place of Rick Spinrad, both who signed on to as stakeholders to this effort.
Okay, thanks.
We also provided some background materials for the committee in this folder. So this presentation's enclosed in that, as well as an executive summary to the report that we're going to touch on, and a letter of endorsement from all the stakeholder organizations that helped pull this together. But first, let me introduce what we're actually talking about. We're speaking about the Sustainable Aviation Fuels Northwest Project. And we'd like to call your attention to the results of the project. The intent of the study was to examine the feasibility, the challenges, and the opportunities of developing safe, economically viable, sustainable aviation biofuels industry in the Northwest U.S. So we're not here today to advocate for or against any particular piece of legislation or recommendation. Really, we're just here to give you an opportunity to take a glimpse into the work that's been done over the last 10 months. There are literally about 100 recommendations in the report, so we would simply point out that in the executive summary, there's a link to a website with the full report, and we would simply ask that you take a look at that and consider the recommendations. Over the next couple of years, many of us who are stakeholders in this issue will be back, no doubt, to discuss some of the specific recommendations. But the study was conducted by the SAFN Group, which is really a consortium of aviation leaders in the Northwest, led by Boeing and Alaska Airlines in particular, but also including Port of Portland, Port of Seattle, Spokane Airport, and Washington State University. Oregon State University was a key player as well from Oregon. Why are we here? As I said, there's really an economic, environmental, and national security imperative to replace petroleum fuels with alternative fuels for the aviation industry. Compared to ground transportation and the energy sector, aviation doesn't have as many options to power itself. We can't use electricity to power aircraft, for instance. And so for the next 20 or 30 years, aviation is really going to need liquid, high energy density fuels to be able to meet its environmental, economic, and national security goals. And when we talk about aviation, we're talking about both civilian and military. So the SAFIN study makes specific recommendations and details a clear pathway for how the Northwest can develop this industry and provide jobs and meet its various goals. So really we're here to provide a glimpse into what the project and the findings are, and we're going to move along pretty quickly and give you that, give you a sense, and then we can, if you'd like, you can interrupt us and ask questions, or you can hold it to the end, whatever works for you. From the beginning, the leaders recognized the need to gather knowledge and perspective from a wide range of stakeholders in the Northwest, including agriculture, forestry, research institutions, financiers, biofuel suppliers, and others. And to that end, we pulled together a group of over 40 stakeholders and observers. And in Oregon, or from Oregon, that included groups such as Oregon Environmental Council, Oregon State University, Sun Grant School of Agriculture, various Oregon agricultural groups, Tammy Denny, who many of you may know, was a stakeholder, Oregon Department of Agriculture, and others. Really, the credibility of this work is and lies in the partnership and the collaboration required to complete the work. And we didn't always agree. But one thing we did do was we came to agreement on consensus for what the key recommendations needed to be to move forward to create this industry. The collaboration and the partnership is definitely going to be required to move this forward and for the benefit of the Northwest. As you can see from your packet, each of the stakeholders signed an endorsement letter. And you can tell that there's a huge range of perspectives. The National Resource Defense Council, Oregon Environmental Council, farmers, forestry, research institutes, processors, all signed the letter of endorsement for the final report. So that's a highlight, and the collaboration is going to be required to really continue to move this forward. This report is really sort of the end of the beginning. There is a lot of work to be done going forward, and my colleagues here will take a few minutes to describe some of the details. And with that, I'll hand this over to Darren Morgan from Boeing.
So Phil went a bit deep into the Pacific Northwest. What I'll do is step back and talk about the global context for aviation. We're doing a lot of similar activities literally all over the planet, Boeing and other stakeholders. So I'll talk a little bit about that and sort of some of the global drivers. Firstly, in the Pacific Northwest especially, but in the United States and globally, aviation is a big part of the economy. You all know that very well, especially in this region. We contribute to a very large percentage of jobs in this region. And so we wanted, as we're moving out globally on this strategy to develop sustainable aviation fuels, we wanted to make sure we had a solid process and effort in place here in the Pacific Northwest, our home, where aviation is so vitally important. So that was our sort of motivation to work on this locally. Airlines spend a lot of money on fuel. Megan, in a little bit, will testify to that in more detail. But a large cost driver for airlines today is fuel. It usually is one or two in terms of ranking between fuel and labor costs. So one of the drivers for this industry globally and locally is mitigating cost over the long term. There's some challenges to the fuel availability for aviation in the long term because it's a small part of the transport fuel pool globally. So we see that as a challenge for our industry. We want a healthy customer base, Boeing does, and so we are seeking these fuels to diversify our fuel supply for our industry going forward. Nobody has more interest than us in seeing that diversification, so we decided to get very active, proactive in developing that diversity strategy. Just like you'd invest in a wide range of portfolio options in your personal investment strategy, we are seeking a wider range of fuel options for our industry. So fuel costs and availability is one driver. The other big one is climate change. in the European Union and in other places politically. They are going to put various costs on our industry in various ways to pay for carbon. In many of those regulatory regimes, they allow for biofuel use to be exempt from those costs, provided it meets sustainability criteria, which we're working on. And so that is another driver. So mitigating the impact of climate change from our fuel use, and also diversifying fuel supply. So let's see. Let's go to the next slide. A little bit of context. We're a very small part of the greenhouse gas pie, as it were. However, left unchecked, left unmitigated, our share will grow. We estimate from 2 to 3%, all other things being equal, if we don't do something to change our trajectory. So a small piece of the global greenhouse gas pie, but a potentially growing piece. So the industry has asked very deeply for the past several years, what can we do differently? And the answers have come up, well, better airplanes. We do that. We've always done that. Alaska is one of the leaders in adopting those better airplanes. So we're doing that. We can fly the airplanes more efficiently. So the airspace navigation can be optimized in ways that it isn't today very well optimized. And again, Alaska is one of the leaders in adopting some of the technologies needed to fly airplanes more precisely and therefore lower fuel use. So we can do those things to reduce our fuel use and our emissions at the same time. But if you add up those two things together, you can't get to carbon neutral growth. The industry is committed to a goal of carbon neutral growth, which means that taking a baseline year of 2006, we want to get to a position where the industry is emitting carbon at the rate that it is in 2006 while it grows. So we can fly better airplanes doing that. We can navigate more efficiently. That's kind of the blue wedge there in that chart. But to get down to the gray baseline of carbon neutral growth, you have to change the fuel. There's just no other way. We can't do electric hybrid airplanes. We can't do other things. All of our advanced scientists would love to get off liquid hydrocarbons of various flavors to power airplanes, but it's not in the cards. And it's not just us. It's Airbus, Bombardier, all the OEMs, all the airframe manufacturers in the planet view this as a long-term need. Liquid hydrocarbon fuels are going to have to be the way. So if we want to get to carbon-neutral growth, we've got to change the fuel to something of a more carbon-neutral nature. So over the past several years, the industry is engaged in a significant technical program globally. It's one of the most significant things actually happening in the industry today, aside from better airplanes and flying them more efficiently. We have worked with engine manufacturers, airlines all over the planet to sort of prove the concept. The first one was Virgin Atlantic in 2008. Actually, I've got a sample of that right here. This is the stuff that Richard Branson flew on. It's a sample of biojet fuel, the first one ever flown on. Subsequent to that, though, the technology's improved, and the fuels are actually superior in terms of performance to petroleum jet fuel, superior in terms of performance. So slightly more thermally dense, a little more energy, so slightly lower fuel burn, no sulfur, so lower emissions, and, of course, the carbon-neutral nature of biofuels if you do them right generally. So there's a lot of very positive things that the industry really didn't expect when we started looking at this several years ago, but it turns out the technical performance of the fuels is actually better than petroleum jet fuel. So I mentioned that we're doing this all over the world. There are similar stakeholder efforts going on around the planet. In fact, literally the same day we announced the results from the Northwest Project down under, a similar project in Australia that we and others are working on announced. In Mexico, they're working on a similar effort around economic development, sustainability, bringing sort of higher incomes in rural areas. All the way over to China, there's a significant cooperation between ourselves and the Chinese government. Of all places, the UAE, which has about 7% of the world's oil, they're actually committed significant resources to renewable energy because they're eventually going to run out, and they've committed to a very significant renewables program. The point is, this is happening everywhere, not just here. We want to make this region one of the leaders in the world for all kinds of reasons. And I think that's it for me. Thanks.
Thank you. I'll highlight now for you some of the key objectives and findings of the report. So there are three basic objectives in starting this effort. One of them was to make sure that we looked at what are the most promising feedstocks in the Northwest region, looking at Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Montana. Not only what are the most promising feedstocks from a sustainability standpoint, but also what can we bring to commercial scale so that the industry is actually economically viable. Two was to make sure we looked at all aspects of the supply chain, from the actual production of the feedstock to harvesting, refining capacity, transporting to the airport, and then actual use by the airlines, because all of those pieces are essential. And then third, making sure that we look at what are those key policy recommendations, what are the priority recommendations, both from the federal and state side, that we can make that will actually accelerate this process going forward in terms of the development of this industry. And so here, and Darren might jump in here as well, but I think one of the key things that we found in going through this 10, 11-month exercise is that we have a diverse portfolio of feedstocks in the Northwest region, so some great potential there. We have some key processing technologies to employ, and we also have a distribution pipeline already in place. So some of those key essentials of that supply chain are already in place in our Northwest region. And we're proud to say after this, I think it was 11 months of work, that we finally actually produced this report. We released it last Wednesday, and we did events in Washington, D.C., in Washington State, sort of outlining some of those key recommendations. And as was mentioned previously by Phil, one thing we're very proud of is that even though there was this diverse group of stakeholders involved, 40-plus participants, that we were all able to gain consensus on the key recommendations in the report. And so our hope now is that this report doesn't just sit on a table or a shelf somewhere, but that it actually is a catalyst for our action going forward. So a few of the key recommendations in the report, and the full report will detail all the specific ones, but one is that an aviation biofuels industry should be a priority, both from a commercial and a policy perspective, and that was already sort of touched on a bit previously. But again, the two key reasons from my perspective is that aviation is a critical economic driver in our country, and there isn't that alternative that other transport sectors have. We need that liquid, energy-dense fuel. Two would be the biofuel development for, I went backwards. Please forgive me. The first recommendation is that this can actually happen in the Northwest. So just to back up there, sorry, Phil. We have the raw material in place in the Northwest, as I touched on. We have the political will, as this report shows. You know, we brought forth the key stakeholders, not only all the ones Phil mentioned, but also state and local government entities were involved as well. So we think we have the political will in place that will be very important. We have key elements of the supply chain in place. We have a large market in the Northwest for fuel. We consume 800 million gallons a year between military and commercial airlines, and so that's a large market. So now it's just a matter of harnessing all those raw materials and actually making this industry happen. And then the third finding, since I went backwards here, is that we do have these promising feedstocks that's been alluded to. So the report focuses on four key feedstocks, and the key point here is that we're not pointing to one as the silver bullet, but sort of looking at them as a portfolio of options. So those would be oil seeds, forest residue, municipal solid waste, and algae.
And I'm going to jump in for a second and give you a little bit of background on why the Sun Grant was involved in this and sort of the role and why I think we actually became a bigger partner along with WSU as it went on. And that is that one of the biggest challenges of standing this industry up is the feedstock development piece. And so the Western Regional Sun Grant is modeled after the land grant. There's five Sun Grant centers around the country. Cornell, South Dakota, Tennessee, Oklahoma State, and Oregon State, and we represent all the western states, including Alaska, Hawaii, and the Pacific Islands and territories. And the Sun Grant was founded 10 years ago under the concept of, interesting enough, that everything that petroleum is just millions of years old plants. So everything that we make out of petroleum can come from plants. And so the idea of the Sun Grant was we call it a biorefinery or a bioeconomy. And initially it was about higher valued products and co-products. And over the last 10 years, the focus on the energy component, which is really in most biorefineries kind of the lowest value constituent, has taken precedence. But there's been a big focus on the bioenergy. And so the Sun Grant mission is to, through development, distribution, and implementation of bio-based technologies, the Sun Grant will enhance rural energy security, provide opportunities for rural economic development, promote environmentally sustainable and diversified production opportunities for agriculture and forestry resources, and encourage further bioenergy research collaboration between government agencies, private firms, and land-grant universities. So that's the Sun Grant's mission from 10 years ago, with bioenergy focused rather than the bioeconomy. And so kind of obvious why the SAFN project was one that was consistent with the Sun Grant and the traditional land grant interests of Washington State and Oregon State University. And so so our interest has really been in these in helping with the feedstock development. And as Megan indicated, there's four feedstock platforms that were identified. And I think the key thing here is there's no silver bullet that's going to take a diversified portfolio. And this diagram, I think, roughly shows you when we see the different feedstocks coming on and roughly the relative contribution that they'll make. And so the thinking is that the oil seeds and camelina in particular would be the first one out of the gate. It's been tested and converted. That mucilaginous solid waste and the woody materials would be the next two, and probably the biggest one long term, but probably the furthest away, is the algae platform. We see it taking all four, and then the second thing about each of these feedstocks is that there's a real concern about diverting current food products to fuel, the food versus fuel sort of concern. And so we're not looking at taking biomass materials that currently have a high value as a food or feed ingredient or in terms of wood products, but really trying to look at what are now underutilized or waste materials or alternative crops or biomass. And so it's not like we have large amounts of these already sitting out there, because we're trying to develop a new industry and not divert existing materials. So each of these platforms has some challenges. The oilseed challenge is primarily one of agronomics and building understanding the agronomics to grow it on a large scale, to do it deal with the weeds and other pests, and to do that in a way that's economically viable for the farmer and converts to a fuel at a competitive price. For the forest residue and thinnings, the challenges there are actually probably bigger on the conversion side. There's still probably bigger challenges in terms of converting those materials as cost-effectively as compared to the oil seeds. The other big challenge is, frankly, just the cost and the logistics associated with the collection and delivery and sort of pre-processing piece. A third one that's of interest is municipal solid waste. And these are already collected. There's some advantage there. The challenge is there, though, that sort of represents a change in the system. There needs to be additional conversations around the role that converting these to energy, how that fits into the current sort of municipal solid waste management strategies. And then finally, algae. And algae, again, the conversion, it's lipid, it's sort of like the oil seeds, is not that big of a challenge. The real challenge on algae is the dewatering of it. You're going to get to a product you can burn, and you have a lot of water to start with, and the expenses of getting the oil out of the algae and the oil out of the water. So, and in all four of these, because they're essentially new systems, new uses for either existing products or new products, is the full life cycle sustainability analysis that would be required for them. I will mention here that, just ad lib a bit, that Megan indicated that, you know, the report is designed to spur action, and I thought I would just point out that the Western Regional Center, along with University of Hawaii and WSU, Washington State University in particular, partnered in the development of three $45 million each USDA bioenergy CAPS grants, and one on camelina. All three of them were basically around the farm-to-fly or the SAFIN aviation biofuels concept. One of them was on the camelina feedstock platform, and the other two were on the woody biomass platforms. And we expect to hear sometime this month on those. Word is on the street that we'll be getting some money out of that effort. A second action that was spurred by the SAFIN effort was, and you notice that the Navy was a stakeholder and signer, is that we met with Navy representatives in Hawaii and then in D.C. over the last 3 or 4 months and have a couple of proposals in front of the Navy to help jumpstart this industry as well, building on the CAPS grants. If it's if camelina gets funded, then we'd be looking for help from the Navy on the woody. If woody gets funded, we'd be looking for help from the Navy on camelina, and Jatropha in the islands is a high lipid-based crop that has a lot of promise in the tropics. And the Navy's interest is having a global supply chain, so they're very interested in the tropical areas. And then the third thing I would mention, literally just this afternoon at 2 o'clock, a $6 million proposal went into Department of Energy in the biomass R&D, Birdie, it was called Birdie, that was on the algae platform, and it has one of the co-signers, Stan Barnes from BioAlgene, and 11 other participants besides OSU as part of that consortium, again looking to try to move the algae platform ahead. So in fact, the report's been out a week, but it's already spurred a lot of action, I think, amongst the various stakeholders and amongst the firms. Fourth key finding, and the third key finding was around the stakeholders, but the fourth key finding and recommendation is that supportive policies are critical to jumpstart the industry and attract investment, accelerate industry growth, and provide long-term economic benefits. And there's a long line of policies that the SAFIN group talked about. I think the bottom line is, particularly from the feedstock point of view, is kind of a level playing field. So that you know, the biofuel industry is competing in a level playing field with petroleum. And secondly, anytime you have a new industry like that, the risk management is a key piece. And so people are going to make these kind of investments. They need to have long-term contracts. They need to have some way of sharing risk or managing risk in a way that allows them to make those big upfront investments. And so you'll hear things about extending crop insurance. I think Representative Inslee from Washington State just introduced a bill in Congress to allow the Defense Department to enter into 15-year contracts, which would be a critical sort of long-term risk management, price risk management. So those will be important, and I expect that some of those will arise at, obviously already at the federal level, and some may arise at the state level, and we've been working with USDA and Defense and others on forwarding that. And then the last one, key finding, was that aviation fuels must be developed sustainably. And as you heard from the industry, you know, a key thing here is the cost of fuel and the carbon footprint greenhouse gas emissions footprint. And so in sustainability, there's staff and stakeholder groups spend a lot of time sort of screening those things. We use the roundtable on sustainable biofuels was not formally adopted, but that was used to identify sort of the screening criteria, and that included the greenhouse gas emissions, the food security or the food versus fuel concerns, conservation, soil erosion, water use, air pollution, waste management, labor, and sort of fair labor management. So there's lots of different dimensions that go into this sort of sustainability screen, and those were a big part of the conversation and a big part of the diverse set of stakeholders that was there. And frankly, that's one of the research pieces that are part of the proposals I talked to you about, the CAPS grant, the Birdie proposal, and discussions with Navy, is that all of those are requiring a sort of a sustainability life cycle screening analysis. So that's a big part of the research as well. And so I think with that, the basic conclusion is that the Northwest can realize a sustainable aviation fuel industry through regional collaboration and policy support. And I will say one other thing on that is that imitation is the greatest flattery. You know, this group, when it first started with John Gardner, was part of the Sun Grant group as well. There was a term called farm to fly, I think was one of the original terms that was coined. And about a year ago, that got adopted by USDA and kind of announced as a USDA initiative. And so we gladly gave him farm to fly, and SAFIN showed up on my radar screen. But it has, I think, gotten a lot of attention nationally and on both the commercial and the defense side for the reasons that stated earlier about the kind of unique market that aviation fuels represent in terms of a unique need for liquid high-energy fuels compared to many of our other current uses, and a real coalescing of expertise and interest in the Northwest.
So that concludes our formal presentation. I think you can see that you just got a glimpse into the drivers, the assets that we have in the Northwest here in Oregon to make this happen, the political will. And as I said before, this is really just sort of the end of the beginning, this partnership and collaboration that we need to continue to actually turn this vision into reality. And with that, we're more than happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Well, at great risk to his legislative agenda, Representative Gilliam is allowing me to continue holding the gavel for the rest of this informational session. There are some questions. I have to say, first of all, this makes me much more comfortable driving back home in Representative Bailey's B99 truck, because if he can run B9, if you guys can run biofuels in your airplanes, then I'm pretty sure he can safely bring me home using his B99.
We'll be flying down the highway, Mr. safely.
I'm going to turn to Representative Thompson for the first question.
Thank you. Bill, I've been following this for years, but one of the concerns I have, and maybe you can address it, is that we do these research projects, and they're really interesting, but I'm not seeing the global connection from soil to mass production. And a couple of the concerns for crops here. I mean, tropical plants are wonderful, but you build the fuel and you got to transport it, and that costs a lot of money. So we really want to talk about fuel we can grow here. And with that, you quickly get into the problem of what can we do that takes very little chemical fertilizer, because most of that's coming from petroleum. We can grow anything if we have enough fertilizer, but we don't. And the other is water. Are there any models being developed that really look at tens of thousands of acres of something that we can, well, except for this year, grow in a spring season that doesn't require late summer irrigation, because we don't have the irrigation water or haven't developed it, and that don't require large amounts of chemical fertilizer, especially nitrogen?
Yeah, well, very good observation, Representative Thompson. The two or three thoughts on that. First is there's no free lunch, and so you can't grow high volumes of crop biomass on poor lands with inadequate water and inadequate nutrients, and so there's nothing magical about it. I think that's probably what led to the portfolio approach here, mm-hmm. and that the you know, this industry couldn't stand alone on oil seeds long term. It would take too many acres, and it would take away from high valued other uses. So that's kind of the closest and gets it started. And those are actually being looked at in terms of camelina as opposed to canola or soybean oil. And camelina is more tolerant of low water and low nutrients than are the food crops. And it's also being looked at in as a crop rotation in existing wheat, dryland wheat.
Okay.
So that what normally would be the fallow year, they would put the camelina on and grow it with water that was in the soil. So I think in a rotation like that, it will work at the kind of levels that are envisioned here.
Good.
The other thing I would say, back to your point, is that the Jatropha oils and those agave even, although tequila would be hard to give up, that the Navy in particular, and I think the airlines, you know, Boeing indicated they have these conversations going on all over the world. You know, these planes land here, but they fuel everywhere else and come back.
Yeah.
So the Navy actually wants a worldwide supply chain, and so they want stuff that could be produced in Hawaii or Guam or places like that, or even in Asia proper. So that's part of their interest, is the broader ones. The other piece is that I think where we'll see in the Pacific Northwest, one of the real advantages is in the woody waste trimmings and existing wood sources. If we can get the collection and conversion pieces down, just using private lands and the trimmings from existing wood harvests that are trimmed at the loading point, there's some real advantages there to that. It's it doesn't require new land or new uses. It's another extension of that. And then finally, I think a lot of people who are in this business see algae as having the great potential because just of the yields per unit area, and the fact that there are algae varieties that will grow in salt water and brackish water and you name it. So lots of different varieties that won't require fresh water sort of resources. The Birdie proposal that went in today with the bioalgene and NETL and consortium universities is really, and PG is looking at growing algae in the waste in cooling water ponds for the, like PGE at the Boardman plant, as a way of sequestering the carbon into the algae and then harvesting the algae and converting that, you know, into a biofuel and energy. So they're looking at those kinds of opportunities where you have waste heat and a water supply, and you get sort of a waste treatment in addition to the byproduct. But it's going to take something like that. It's not that we got all this land and water out there and we can go create a new corn industry like my home state of Iowa.
This is my concern, because these projects work really well until we start talking about we're really going to fuel the aircraft industry, and then the gallons go right to the roof, you know, and it quickly leaves the research bench.
Yeah, the beauty of the airline industry is, large as it is, it's relatively small compared to the overall, and that's another reason that, and made the points about the unique characteristics of airline fuel use, that we think this makes it a high priority for the biofuels. But you don't have the electricity and some of the other opportunities. And it's a fairly daunting number of gallons of fuel, but reasonable given the calculations, something that's certainly doable. It wouldn't be doable for all of the ground transportation. That's sort of beyond the capacity of the Northwest.
I'd suggest that one of the other uniquenesses is that there are relatively few purchasers of aviation fuel, unlike power or vehicle fuel. I mean, you can all get in a room and talk about your purchasing habits. And I know Representative Boone and Bailey have questions as well. Why don't we go there next, Representative?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Thompson asked one of my questions, but it segues into the second piece, and maybe for Megan or Darren. So has anybody thought of using less fuel in terms of, instead of, you know, just that when you tug out and tug back in, you're just using a little short, why don't they tug all the way out to the runway, and then when they come in, pick them up, so that you're not using that fuel just for that long run?
Well, I can say that I know that we try and do a single engine taxi, at the airports where it's conducive to that, depending on the congestion level. So that's something that Alaska and many airlines do across the country, is do a single engine taxi, and that reduces quite a bit of fuel burn and carbon emissions throughout the country.
And I had one other question, maybe for
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask earlier if the bag is worse if you're on a plane that's run on tequila, but that was probably old now. I was actually curious a little bit more about, you're looking for a concentrated liquid fuel, and clearly that's available in the biofuel sector. It would seem that also you could theoretically use hydrogen or some sort of other way of storing renewable energy as a liquid fuel. How far along is that research, or is that part of the process at all, and if not, why has it been rejected?
So with respect to hydrogen specifically, our advanced concepts folks have looked at it, Airbus as everybody's has. The issue with hydrogen is, what's the source? How do you get it? So far, you really can't get it affordably and sustainably. And secondly, to do that on an airplane would require specific designs that would be quite substantially different than today. So the question is, to develop a new airplane is a $10 to $15 billion proposition. Who's going to develop an airplane for an energy source that is going to require fundamentally different designs and make it a design that will only be compatible with that fuel? So our ground rule from the beginning has been, it has to be a drop-in fuel. Airplanes have 20, 30-year lives, and so we can't design airplanes that will run on boutique, non-miscible fuels using separate supply chains and infrastructure. Generally speaking, the view of hydrogen as a motive fuel for aviation is it's just a non-starter. You have to have a very, very large enclosure vessel. The physics of that mean a lot of weight. It just doesn't make a lot of sense, especially when hydrogen doesn't exist. One sort of touching on Representative Thompson's point that I think is a sort of a summary level of what's going on globally on biomass. There's something fundamentally new going on. So the Green Revolution, which powered sort of the 20th century, Norm Borlaug, more fertilizer, more land, more water, that worked for a while, and now we're running into constraints. What's really started happening in the past 5 years, 10 years maybe, and Bill, I think you know this very well, so I'm not saying anything new here, is a lot of smart money, government, private, have started investing in new types of biology that can do more with a lot less. So really this pathway of developing types of biology and plant systems that can operate on little or no fresh water, little or no NPK fertilizer, little or non-arable land. Literally, we're working in the desert in the UAE with none of those things, and it's actually going very well because of some advanced biology that's available that people have just started to look at. So, we've worked on corn for 10,000 years and perfected it to the point where it's got some potential for improvement, but not a lot. We're talking about plant sources and types and systems that are fundamentally new and people haven't really thought of, with the constraint in mind of, non-arable land being required. You don't need chemical fertilizers, and you can't have access to unlimited fresh water. So that's one thing that's fundamentally new here.
Follow-up person.
Follow-up comment. I think I just heard you say plant types that are fundamentally new and nobody has thought of yet. So I think under that heading, it'd be hard not to call that a boutique fuel. And I get the point about fundamental redesign of the aircraft, and you're looking for a drop-in fuel, and that may or may not be an insurmountable barrier to using hydrogen. As you well know, hydrogen is simply the splitting of water, which is done with electricity, which comes from windmills and solar panels. It's basically a battery. So it's not actually very hard to get hydrogen. And if we're going to create infrastructure for something, we've got to look at something that could be made from something that's truly sustainable and carbon neutral. That may be the case with some of these next generation biofuels. We've been burned on biofuels before, and we just encourage you, as you do that research, to continue along that line of looking at life cycle carbon neutrality, and hopefully some of your research and your advancement on these new plants and these new types of biofuels will spill over into the vehicle, into the automotive industry.
So there's a piece of research published by the Masdar Institute, it's a joint venture between MIT and the UAE's institute there, that looks at exactly that. They ask the question, if you have biomass, should you turn it into hydrogen? Should you turn it into liquid hydrocarbons? And looking at the displacement, or, you know, what do you displace as an alternative from a highest and best perspective? In other words, lower greenhouse gas emissions on the net. And the answer they're coming up with thus far in the peer-reviewed research that they've done with MIT is that the best thing you can do is displace increasingly carbon-intense liquid hydrocarbons today. We definitely look at hydrogen, have looked at it for a very long time, and thus far the answer is you just can't do it up in the air. Not to say that it won't happen on the ground, but there's a lot that has to happen to make it happen on the ground, and you have to make the case that it makes more sense to do that than just substituting for a liquid hydrocarbon replacement.
Thanks. I just want to confirm, really, following up on this conversation, when you, I think it's the case, based on everything that you've said, that when you make this assessment, liquid hydrocarbon, looking at, you know, conventional fuels versus biofuels, you are considering the life cycle emissions associated with the fuel from production through transportation and emissions.
Absolutely.
In the report, you begin with this this story about a plane taking off in 2020 powered on biofuels. How did you pick the date 2020 as a target for biofuel-powered airplanes, and how realistic is that?
Let's take that.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that, I mean, from the scientific perspective, that would be, you know, Darren, but I would say that, you know, the industry, as was alluded to before, have these various carbon emission reduction targets, and so that is one of the sort of aims of the industry collectively, is to reach that carbon neutral growth target. And so I think we all would say it'll take several years to get, probably more than several years to get to this 50-50 blend. But I think that that is just basically an aim of the industry at this point.
Yeah, go ahead.
The other point I would make is the Roundtable on Sustainable Biofuels has sort of worldwide has provided some guidelines on sustainability, and particularly the sort of the full life cycle carbon balance, and comes back to the other points that were raised. Also, you know, the goal here is to not use irrigated crops. And so a couple of comments on that. One is that for my money, the real starters are where the fuel comes from existing waste products, as opposed to something that's being developed or grown specifically for the fuel. And so I think that's where municipal solid waste, that's where using the algae to sequester carbon from existing coal-fired power plants, that's where using the wood trimmings from existing private forest lands for wood that's already going to sawmills and pulp mills and so forth, has some real advantages over trying to grow an agronomic crop specifically for this use. And so I think there'll be lots of pieces of that. Coming back to the genetics, I think the better way to frame that is that a lot of existing genetic materials that current genomics techniques allow us to make much more rapid advances in the genetics of existing crops, as opposed to crops we haven't even thought of yet. For example, these proposals I talked about all have significant genetic research in them to enhance the oil content of the algae, to increase the yield of camelina, to allow the camelina to be more water tolerant. And so, a lot of that work has been done in corn, but hasn't been done in some of these other crops. And so there are, geneticists believe there are lots of potentials to increase the efficiencies, and particularly when you start looking at it from the standpoint of you're trying to convert it to a fuel. So what characteristics of the plant could be manipulated to enhance that. And there's a lot of work also going on in terms of other sort of co-products that can that plants can manufacture. Like I said, anything that comes from petroleum, we can come from plants. I mean, because it was a plant originally, and so there are ways to do it with carbohydrates and plant materials. And so there's lots of opportunity there, and lots of work, fundamental work being done on the genetic side.
Thank you. Co-Chair Gilley, final comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you all for coming. I was at first disappointed because I thought we were going to get a presentation finally from Annette Price, but I was not disappointed in the presentation, so thank you for your work on this. And I have to say, I'm encouraged and impressed that this came forward, or you've been working on this. It's mostly industry-based with your other partners, and I think that is commendable. I don't know what the next steps are for the project. I would point out, when I look at the observers, as far as I know, we in Oregon still have a congressional delegation. So I just thought I'd point that out. Comment on that?
May I?
Yes, certainly.
Very briefly, the Oregon delegates have been joined at the hip on this, been fully informed as the process has been going on, and a number of them received briefings last week in D.C. on this.
Excellent. Thank you for mentioning that. I was just actually kind of teasing you a little. And the other thing I would say is, as you go forward, if there's some other steps, I would just briefly mention another aspect to this whole hydrogen issue. Representative Cann and Representative Bailey have been particularly helpful in this regard in sort of promoting some of the early research and testing. And that is this, when Representative Thompson's question prompts this. There is a process now where you can crack the hydrogen out of water. And the best way to store it is in anhydrous ammonia, because for some strange scientific reason that I don't understand, it's richer in hydrogen molecules than liquid hydrogen. So you can store it safely. And the byproduct, and this is why I've always been interested in this process for my district, in this fertilizer, this non-petroleum-based fertilizer. So there may be a conversation that you might all want to have with some folks over at the Northwest Hydrogen Alliance on that subject. It's not ready to go. It's not something that's going to make a difference tomorrow. But as you look forward to the kind of dates that we alluded to, this could be an important part of providing the kind of safe, local, better fertilizer that Representative Thompson alluded to. So I just suggest that, and I'd be glad to give you those contact. And I guess lastly, my question would be to Ms. Lawrence. Ms. Lawrence, you are with my favorite airline.
Oh, thank you.
And I just want to know, though, I'm really bugged by one thing. Do MVPs actually ever get upgraded? Because I've never actually seen this.
No, it depends on the flight. It can be tricky. I hate to say that. I know. I knew I'd get a question like that, though.
You don't let her get off the hook that easily?
Oh, I just thought
now's your chance.
Yeah. You might want to jot down my mileage number.
He's a state representative.
Get my pen out.
Nice try.
Thank you very much for coming. You probably didn't realize you were coming before the Hydrogen Energy Water Committee, but there you are. Welcome. Glad you were here. Appreciate the presentation, and we'll look forward to keeping in touch and learning more. So with that, we'll close the informational session on aviation fuels. And I think the committee will stay on these for a moment before we prepare for a work session, if that's the direction we're heading. And don't go far, because we may not only need your vote but on the bill, but possible rule suspension as well. So we'll need you here.
But I told you, I don't want to tell them.
All right, we're back in session, and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 518. Members, this is our last bill of this session for this committee. Let's do it right.
Okay.
I'll do put on a good show here. Yeah. Louise, come on up and tell us about these amendments. And Representative Benz, I don't know if you have any comments. I think you
no.
requested them.
You don't?
We'll listen. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why don't we listen to Louise, the director, and then go from there.
Okay, great.
Co-chairs Cannon and Gilliam and members of the committee, Louise Soliday, director of the Department of State Lands. I prefer not to practice the art of just-in-time legislating, but here we are. you have in front of you a Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 518, and it's a gut and stuff amendment. It deletes the Section 2 that was in the original bill completely, and then it revisits Section 1. And what it does in Section 1 is it divides our general permits into two categories: general permits that we issue broadly statewide or to a geographic area. And for those, we would go through full-blown rulemaking, which is what we've done for a transportation GP that we have in place and a couple of others. The second category would be one that comes to us through an application. So a watershed council, a soil or conservation district, an irrigation district could be, and anybody, could be a couple of individuals going together applying. And in that case, we would issue these general permits by order. We would do public notice, public comment, just as we do with all of our individual permits, but we would issue by order and not go through the full-blown rulemaking process for those. And for those that are issued by rule, we would, within the rule, identify what anybody who wants to do an individual activity under that general permit would need to do in terms of notifying us or applying to us, whatever the case may be. And the same thing in the order for the other type of general permits, that we would put in the order what process they need to follow to notify us or apply for those individual actions that are covered under that general permit. The old Section 2, which no longer exists, I understand there were concerns about the fact that that section just sent us to rulemaking and actually didn't lay out the specific criteria that we would use to make that judgment on how to price mitigation credits around the state. And so what we've talked to Representative Benz about is, in the interim between now and the 2012 session, that we would go out and have that conversation with our customers and our stakeholders, come back with some specific criteria that we would put into the statute, and then go back and do rulemaking to specifically implement that provision. And that'll give us some time to actually work with the stakeholders and customers on how we might do that. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No questions other than to thank the director for her work on this. And to note that I very much appreciate her explanation of the concerns I had regarding the second part of the original bill, and the hope that the department can provide us with a proposal that perhaps shares a little more of the detail that I think is necessary when we put together a bank of this sort, because of it's a very good device, a clever device, and one that I sure want to have work appropriately. That's as to the second part of the bill, which isn't part of the Dash 2. As to the Dash 2, I think it addresses my concerns.
Great. Thank you.
And one other thing I just might mention, I don't believe you got have a fiscal in front of you. We did send one in this afternoon sometime earlier, but I will tell you there's no fiscal on this, so I just wanted to get that on the record.
Great. Thank you, Louise, and we will be moving the bill forward with, assuming we get rule suspension from the committee, we'll move the bill forward on that basis, and if something strange happens, we'll deal with it. But at this point, I think we're prepared to move ahead. So, Representative Gilliam, or can I look to you for a motion on the amendments?
Yes, you can, Mr. Chair, and I would be happy to give you that motion now. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 518, dated 5/31/11.
Representative Bailey moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments.
He might, but
I would agree
with
the motion.
What did I say?
Representative
Bates. Whoa. Strange. Okay. Representative Gilliam moves to adopt the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 518, dated May 31st, 2011. Is there any discussion? There is not. Is there any objection? Amendments are adopted. Representative Benz, do you have a... Representative Gilliam, do you have a motion on the rule suspension?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to adopt... Actually... Let's go to the suspension now, Mr. Chair, and I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on Senate Bill 518-2 without having the fiscal impact and revenue statements on hand at this time.
Representative Gilliam moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on Senate Bill 518 without having the fiscal impact and revenue statements on hand at this time. Is there any... it's undebatable. So, those of the opinion... Do I really have to say this? Those of the opinion that the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on Senate Bill 518 without having the fiscal impact and revenue impact statements on hand at this time will say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion carries. Have we ever done that before? We are putting on a show.
Yes.
This is our last bill. It's good. So rules are suspended now. A motion on the main bill.
Do you want to call on somebody?
Representative Boone. Sorry, Representative Gilliam.
We look the most alike.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so it is that I move Senate Bill 518-2. Or as amended, to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gilliam moves Senate Bill 518 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Bailey?
Aye.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative
Austin?
Aye.
Representative
Witt?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Krieger?
Excuse.
Co-Chair Cannon?
Aye.
Co-Chair Gilliam?
Aye.
Motion carries. Senate Bill 518 heads to the floor. I guess we need a carrier. Any volunteers? Representative Benz, would you like to carry the bill?
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Benz will carry the bill. And with that, we are going to close the work session. And Mr. Chair?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, you're not going to believe this because of, you know, all the tomfoolery here at the end. But I did want to say this about you on this last day of working bills. We have a couple more meetings? No.
We could have.
We might have more meetings. But nonetheless, I just wanted to say, I've been thinking a little bit since floor session today, and I wanted to be very clear to this committee and to anybody that may be listening how much I appreciate your work on this committee and enjoy working with you. This is a strange building, and I think it is hard sometimes to keep politics, whatever, however you define that word, out of things. But if there's anybody that has done it, and done it with great sincerity and hard work and openness to discussion and compromise, it is you. So whatever we may agree on, and there's a lot, or disagree on, which happens occasionally, I just wanted to compliment you on your motives and on your hard work and on your leadership. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you, Representative Gilliam. I can't let that go by without saying a few words about you. If someone had proposed heading into this evenly divided session that I would co-chair a committee with Representative Gilliam, I would have thought, do I get a say in the matter? But in fact, it has turned out really, really splendidly. And I say that with all honesty. I think that we, while we've not agreed on every issue, we have had just extraordinarily open relationship. You've been very candid. You've been very thoughtful in your approach to issues, and I've felt like we were able to work together very, very productively. And I credit your motives and good intention and your willingness to dig in and do hard work and make compromises and try to move things forward in the interests of Oregonians, even if it meant, you know, not getting everything that we wanted. And just been very, very grateful for that. So thank you. It's worked well. With that, we will...
Can I say a few words about Representative Thompson? Fine American. That's great. great guy.
Literature.